euphoria of the opium. But she absolutely hated it when I was shooting the cocaine. Then I'd turn into a freak and disappear. Of course, I never wanted to shoot just heroin. So when we were shooting heroin in her room, I'd sneak out to do a hit of coke. But she was the total eagle eye. No, you're not. Give me the coke. Give me the syringe. You're not shooting coke. I came up with these horrible and deceptive ways of getting high on coke. By then, my hair was so long and matted that I'd slide syringes up into the undercarriage of my hairdo and consent to a full-body pat-down. I'd previously hidden the coke in a cereal box in the kitchen, so I'd rush downstairs and shoot up before Jennifer or her sister or her mom came in. I can't imagine the emotional terrorism that I inflicted on these people. I was lost in that addiction, and it was going to get a lot worse before it got any better. I didn't have any idea how dependent on heroin I was becoming. It seemed like there was an endless supply. All these weird-ass dealers were popping up all over Hollywood. You had the Russian dealer who lived in a shitty apartment with his Russian wife and spoke hardly any English, but had a non-stop supply of China White. You had the white trash mullet-wearing Hollywood dealer on the corner of Sunset Boulevard. You had five or six different Frenchmen, from my old friend Fabrice to Dominique to Francois, and then five other people they knew. If I was copping from Fab, I could go over to his house with $50 and get a bindle that would last me a day, probably a tenth of a gram. But if I had to go to the Russian guy, who was a shyster, I'd give him $50 and it would be good for one poke. Of course, I didn't go there with $50. I went with 22, begging for the $50 bindle and offering to leave my shoes. Russians don't appreciate a negotiation, but that didn't stop me from hounding and begging and bickering and sleazing. I would sit there and wear that bitch out, make him feel the misery before I would. The other French guys were pompous, arrogant, heartless dealers. Not a lot of fronting going on there. They were all dope fiends, too, so they knew what it was to need a little something to get well. But if you weren't a girl and you didn't have a lot of money, good luck. So I had to work every angle imaginable. I wasn't beneath showing up with a copy of our first record. I don't know if you've seen this record here, but this is my band. That's me, there. I've got a manager who's holding a couple $1,000s of mine right now. I'm going to reach him later. I don't know if you feel like coming to the show that we're having next week. Of course, you and your girlfriend would be welcome to attend. Any scam, any lie, any bullshit tactic whatsoever. It was a humiliating, god-awful place in which to find myself. Somehow, I was maintaining and still writing music and showing up to rehearsals more often than not. But without me really knowing it, my life was starting to leave me. I became broom-handle thin. Then the cops busted the old Fabster, which kiboshed his business. He went from dealing and being able to inhale monster lines of smack to having no smack, no cash flow, no customers, and a huge habit. Next thing I knew, Fab had aligned himself with a young Mexican guy. I called him Johnny Devil, because he was, quite obviously, the devil incarnate on planet Earth. Charming enough for you to want to hang out with him, and clever and conniving enough for you to see other faces that weren't his. But I liked him. He never burned me, and he was fair and generous and kind in his evil, devilish ways. My habit was getting worse, and my money was diminishing rapidly, so I had to do the pawn shop thing. Every day I woke up as late as possible, because I knew I was about to get sick. I'd ask Jennifer for $20. There would be no $20. "Do we have anything that we can sell?" I'd plead. "We sold everything." "Can we sell this picture? Can we sell this fire extinguisher? Can we sell this rug? Is there an old radio that no one uses around the house?" I kept going down to the pawn shop with anything I could find to get $20 or $30. Then I'd go meet the man, whether it was the Russian, the Frenchman, or the white trash guy. I'd cop the stuff and go to a little hill at Argyle and Franklin, overlooking the freeway, throw the dope into a spoon, hit it with water, and shoot up immediately. The minute that shit hit me, it was like pouring water on a withered sponge. I'd go from being sick and miserable and weak and devoid of life to frisky and conversational. As soon as I shot the dope, up came the leg of pork, and I'd want to have sex with Jennifer right away. But she'd be mad at me for this ordeal of getting and buying and selling and pawning and copping. One day I woke up, and the cupboards were literally bare. I borrowed Jennifer's sister's bike. I had no intention of pawning it. I was just desperate to get something. I didn't have the time to take the conventional street route to downtown, where the devil lived. So I hopped on this one-speed beach cruiser, rode it out of the apartment grounds, up the on-ramp to the Hollywood freeway, into the right lane of traffic, and peddled my way from Hollywood to downtown Los Angeles. I finally got to Johnny Devil's, but his cash was low, and he was down on his flow. First, we tried melting some Tuinols in a spoon and shooting that, but the minute the powder inside the capsules hit the water, it foamed up. We tried to get the foam into the syringe just to get some relief, but it wasn't working.
"You and I are going to have to find something," he promised,
and we jumped into his car and drove out to the San Bernardino Valley. We stopped in a neighborhood that looked like it could have been uprooted from the poorest section of Tijuana. The whole area was brimming with one-story shacks and dirt yards. On each plot, there were fires burning in oil barrels. There were no windows or doors on the houses. It was like being in Beirut during wartime. Johnny pulled up to the curb and got out of the car.
"You wait here. Don't move," he said,
and disappeared into this labyrinth of streets and houses. I was so weak that I couldn't move if I wanted to. I sat there certain somebody was going to walk up and fill me full of 22s and take the car and leave. Finally, the devil reappeared out of a shadow, far away from where he entered. He was walking that purposeful walk. He got back to the car.
"Did you get it? Did you get it? Did you get it?"
He shot me an agitated look.
"Just chill. Everything's gonna be okay. Don't ask me nothing."
He was obviously in a bad mood. For all I knew, he went in there and killed a family for that shit. He was acting so weird. But as soon as we got out of the neighborhood, he pulled a huge, baseball-sized object out of his coat. It was pure black tar heroin. He twisted off a bazooka gum-sized piece of the stuff and handed it to me, and pocketed the rest.
Are you gonna keep all that? That's a lot. Maybe I can hold on to some of that," I schemed.
"That's how much I need," he said.
We drove to some girl's house in Hollywood, and he proceeded to melt that fucking baseball down, shot after shot, until most of it was gone, all the while never once passing out or ODing or even becoming incoherent. He just settled into his demonic wellness. A few days later, he disappeared, and I never saw him or heard about him again. Despite all my drug use, the writing for the second album was going well. I would watch Hillel and Flea play together, and I'd realize that music was an act of telepathy. That if you were standing next to your soulmate with a guitar in your hand and he with a bass, you could know what the other guy was thinking and communicate that through playing. Hillel had definitely grown as a guitar player in his time away from us. He started off as a Kiss-influenced player with some progressive rock thrown in. Then he experimented with the early Red Hot Chili Peppers, and now he'd come back with a weird, sultry element to his style. It wasn't all syncopated, manic funk. There was something smooth and fluid in his style also. While we were in the EMI rehearsal space on Sunset, we got a call that the legendary impresario Malcolm McLaren wanted to talk to us. McLaren was the mystery man who had created the Sex Pistols and Bow Wow Wow. Now he was looking for the next big thing, and if we were lucky, the star maker would sprinkle his dust on us. He came to a rehearsal with a few cronies, and we played him a couple of our crazy-ass, complicated songs, fast and chaotic and dense and layered, with no rhyme or reason, but a lot of feeling and a lot of funk. He clearly wasn't impressed.
"All right, then, can we have a chat somewhere, mates?"
We walked to a tiny meeting room adjacent to the rehearsal space. Someone started passing around a spliff the size of a Havana cigar.
"Okay, all that stuff you're playing, that's great, but it makes no sense. No one's going to care about that type of music. What I'm envisioning."
He started throwing out words like cacophony and epiphany, and we were getting higher and higher, going, what does he mean by a cacophony of sounds? At last, he got to the point. By way of demonstration, he took out some pictures of surfers who were wearing hot pink punk rock colors.
"I want to take this band and simplify all of the music. Turn it into old 50s rock and roll. Simple as can be. Bass, rote notes, guitar, simple riffs, basic beats. And I want to make Anthony the star, the front man, so there's no confusion. The public can get their head around looking at one central character, and the rest of you will be in the background, playing the most simple rock and roll known to man."
He paused to get our reaction, and I looked over at Flea. Flea had passed out. I guess Malcolm could tell that his message hadn't been well received. I was kind of flattered that he thought I had the potential to be this front man, but everything else he said disavowed everything that we held near and dear to our hearts. It was like the Wizard of Oz had spoken, and what he said was too ludicrous to take seriously. Now it was time for us to make our second record. EMI asked us who we wanted to produce it. Without hesitating, we said, George Clinton. Because after our first record, people came up to us and said, "You must be students of the P-Funk," which was George's legendary funk group. We were latecomers to the Parliament Funkadelic experience, and didn't know as much about George as we should have, or later would, but we knew that if James Brown was considered the godfather, then George was the great god-uncle of funk. So EMI got George on the phone, and we said, "George, we're the Red Hot Chili Peppers. We're from Hollywood, California. We're really hard-rockin' motherfuckers, and we think you should produce our record." We sent him our record and our demo tape, and he liked them. And after Flea and Lindy went out to Detroit to meet him, he agreed to produce us. To this day, when people ask how we got George Clinton, I tell them that we asked him on the phone. But Flea always says, $25,000, which was the amount of money that EMI agreed to pay him. I don't believe he did it just for the money. I think he also saw something special and beautiful and remarkable about these four kids who were attempting to keep the spirit of hardcore funk music alive, not in a pretentious or a copycat way, but by helping to invent a new genre of funk. We went to Detroit with about 70% of the songs finished. We had Jungle Man, my ode to Flea, this half-man, half-beast born in the belly of the volcano in Australia and coming to the world and using his thumb as the conductor of thunder on the bass, American Ghost Dance, Catholic Schoolgirls Rule, and Battleship, whose chorus, Blowjob Park, was inspired by Cliff's true-life adventures fending off blowjob entreaties at Mulholland rest stops while he practiced his vocal lessons. Nevermind and Sex Rap were songs that were on our original demo, and 30 Dirty Birds was an old Hillel camp song. George's vision was that we would hang out in Detroit with him for about a month before we went into the studio, so there was always room to write more songs. We would record in George's studio, called United Sound, which was a two-story brick building in the middle of the barren wasteland that inner-city Detroit had become in the mid-80s. Sometime in the 70s, George had taken over the studio from Motown, and that was where he recorded all those classic Parliament Funkadelic albums. It was a great studio, with big old analog boards, a beautiful drum room, and separate horn rooms. First, the plan was to move into George's house for about a week, until we rented a house for the band. We found a house on Wabeek Lake, which was in the most affluent of all suburbs. So it was this whole triangle of opposites, staying with George in the country, rehearsing downtown, where the land couldn't have cost more than 10 cents a square foot, and living with rich whiteys on a golf course. George lived in a contemporary country house on 50 acres in a place called Brooklyn, which was about an hour outside of Detroit. Even though it wasn't the most attractive countryside around, you could hear the nearby Michigan 500 auto races from his property, it was his sanctuary. There were a fishing pond and nice hills, and his house was graced with the presence of George's beautiful wife. She was totally sweet and maternal, not the vixen of the funk super freak you might think George would be hooked up with, but instead an, "Oh God, wish this was my mom" type of woman. Hillel and I shared a room. Cliff and Flea did the same. Lindy got his own room, and George and his wife were in their master bedroom. The idea was to stay out of the city to get the ball rolling, because we didn't want the sessions to become drug derailed right away. But as soon as I got there, I felt like I had a horrible case of food poisoning. I started throwing up, my skin turned a strange color, and I couldn't eat. I had no idea what was wrong with me, but Flea said, "You're fucking dope sick." I was so clueless that I didn't even realize I was going through a proper heroin withdrawal. For some stupid reason, we sent out for $500 worth of coke, and Lindy and Hillel and Flea and George and I hoofed it all up. That made me feel great for about a half an hour. Then it was back to no sleep and dope sickness. After a few days, it subsided, and we set up shop in George's living room. Drums, guitars, bass, amps. We started playing and getting to know George. To know George is to love him. He's a huge man with huge hair, and there's this other thing about him that's the size of an elephant, his aura. George is a guy who loves to tell stories, and he's not ashamed to admit to all kinds of weird and kooky and questionable behavior. We became the campfire kids listening to the grandmaster of psychedelic funk experience. "George, tell us another story about Sly Stone," and he would be off and running. Besides being a great raconteur, George was teaching us the importance of being regular. He would walk around the house with a bottle of prune juice going, "You all know how old I am. You know how I can go all day and all night. It's because of this. It's because I'm regular." George also had a stuffed animal collection. Where there wasn't furniture, per se, in the house, there were life-size stuffed animals everywhere, some very old. I guess he had been a collector, and his fans and friends and family constantly added pieces, so we were in the middle of this big circus of stuffed animals. After about a week of living with George, we moved into our house on the golf course. Then it was time to start making demos in a studio in downtown Detroit that was owned by a guy called Navarro, who was a colorful but nefarious old-school pimp slash drug dealer slash studio owner. He was an older gentleman, with the lowest, grumbliest, deepest Isaac Hayes Barry White voice. You couldn't understand a lot of what he said, but you sure could understand what he meant. When he walked into the room, no matter who was there, girls, the crew, George, he was the man to respect. So we started doing the demos, and we also started doing the coke, which was everywhere. We'd order the Popeye's chicken, and we'd order the cocaine. And if you could eat the chicken before you got too high in the coke, you'd have dinner. If not, you didn't care about dinner. Unlike us, George never acted like a weirdo when he was high on coke. You wouldn't know whether he was on a ton of coke or not. He just had a really strong constitution. I'd get all tweaked out and try to finish these songs that I had started, and sometimes it would work, and sometimes I'd go in circles, coming up with these complex word combinations. So I was writing, and George was listening to these Hollywood kids playing eccentric hardcore funk music and loving every minute of it. I'd show him some lyrics and ask his opinion, and he'd go, "Wow, that's some outside shit. I love it. Go write another one. We need another verse." At one point during pre-production, Flea, who had been listening to a lot of Meters, suggested that we do a cover of their song Africa. George thought about it and said, "What if you did the song Africa, but had Anthony do a rewrite so it's no longer Africa, but it's your Africa, which is Hollywood?" So I did the rewrite, and George later fashioned one of his incredible vocal arrangements behind it. I think he even sang one or two of the lines in that song. Freaky Styly was another interesting George innovation. That was originally an instrumental overture to lead into another piece, but George was so into that swelling, riding groove that he was adamant it had to be its own song, even if the vocal was simple chanting. When we recorded that music, we were all in the control room listening to that groove, which is still one of the best pieces of music that we ever wrote. George just started chanting, "Fuck 'em, just to see the look on their face. Fuck 'em, just to see the look on their face." We all joined in, and it was a spontaneous bit of musical combustion. The other vocal in that song, "Say It Out Loud, I'm Freaky Styly and I'm Proud," was one of those born-in-the-moment colloquialisms. At that time, we called everything that was cool Freaky Styly. A dance, a girl, a drum beat, anything. When this whole process was finished, and we were sitting around the kitchen table going, "What should we call this album?" Cliff looked up and said, "Why don't we just call it what we call everything else? Freaky Styly." After a little while in Navarro's studio, we finalized the arrangements, and I had some new lyrics ready to go. George had a unique style of producing. It wasn't a lot of super refined high tuning, reacting to every kick drum pattern. It was more from the heart producing. George was a master at hearing backup vocal parts, especially for esoteric parts of the song where you wouldn't normally hear vocals. If you listen to the Funkadelic records or the Parliament records, the vocal arrangements within the body of music are masterpieces unto themselves. So we started hearing that stuff in our songs, and we were open to anything. If he said, "I want to do a five-person vocal at this part in the song," we jumped for joy. We shifted over to United Sound and started recording the basic tracks. We always put down a scratch vocal, because that was the era when you'd record a scratch and then try to beat it. We didn't have comping vocals, where you'd sing a song 20 times and cut and paste the best syllables. George put me in the middle of the room, not off in some other room, so I felt like a part of the band, which was a wise thing to do, since everyone had always said, "Oh, the Chili Peppers are great live, but you'll never capture their zany onstage chemistry in the studio." During the recording process, we started getting an unusual visitor. His name was Louis, and he was a pale and bald Middle Easterner. Turned out he was George's personal coke delivery guy. After a few visits, it was clear that George was into this guy for a lot of money. But George was unflappable. Louis began showing up with a couple of henchmen, and he'd say, in his slow, thick accent, "George, I am a real serious man. You are going to have to make good before I can give you anything else. I'm running a business here." George would go, "Louis, look around. Do you think I'm strapped for cash? In this business, you get paid when you get paid. When I get paid, you're the first motherfucker who gets paid after me." Louis would look pained.
George, I've heard that before. I didn't bring these guys for show, and if they have to hurt somebody...
George never blinked an eye, because he had a plan. He knew Louis was fascinated by the music business, so he intuited that making Louis a part of the whole process would ensure a steady flow of coke. Finally, George promised Louis that he would make his vocal debut on the album. I was thinking, okay, I trust George. I know that everything's happening for a reason here, but I'll be damned if I'm gonna let this motherfucker on my record. This shit is sacred. George told me, don't worry, everyone will be happy. He'll be on the record, and you will not mind. George was right. At the very beginning of Yertle the Turtle, you hear a weird, out-of-context voice come in and say, look at the turtle go, bro. And then the song goes into a syncopated funk beat. That was Louis' debut, and that was what made him happy enough not to hurt somebody. The longer the sessions went on, the more regularly he would show up with the blow, because he was wanting his 15 minutes in the damn spotlight. Right before it was time for me to go in and do the final vocals, I decided I wasn't going to do any cocaine for 2 weeks, which is like deciding to be celibate when you're living in a brothel. My decision had nothing to do with sobriety, because even though I was 23, I was still an emotionally troubled youth. I just didn't want to get back to Hollywood and go, what happened? I had my chance making a record with George Clinton and I fucked up. The 2 week period was the time that was allotted for my vocals. I guess I never realized it was harder to sing when you've got coke dripping down the back of your throat. One of the reasons I was so concerned about my vocals was that during the pre-production process, Flea started to play a Sly Stone song, If You Want Me to Stay, on the bass. Hillel and Cliff got into it, and we decided to cover that song, which was daunting to me, because I can sing anything I write, but another man's tune is always a challenge, let alone one by Sly Stone, one of the most original vocalists in terms of phrasing. George must have sensed my uneasiness.
You have this in the bag. Don't even worry about it. I know what you're capable of, he reassured me.
Then he invited me to his house for the weekend to work on the song. First, I decided to visit my mom for a few days, and I took a tape of the song with me and practiced it over and over again. On the way back from Grand Rapids, I stopped at George's house. We talked about the song and we practiced it, and then we took these long strolls through his property. I didn't even see it, but he was quietly schooling me. We'd be talking about anything under the sun, and he was subconsciously building my confidence and steering me toward getting comfortable and creating magic in the studio. I think he realized that Hillel was a tremendously talented guitar player, Flea knew exactly what he was doing on bass, and Cliff was an ace drummer, but I was this guy with a lyrical ability who wasn't so sure of his voice. Early in the morning, we'd go out fishing in his pond. His whole demeanor changed when he fished. He was no longer the rabble-rousing toastmaster of the funk universe, but more of an introspective, quirky man who had some vast experience. Fishing was his meditation, and he didn't care what we caught. He was eating it. Bluegills, sunfish, catfish, whatever that lake was spitting out was going in the frying pan. We'd catch them and bring them back, and his wife would cook them for breakfast. By the time I left his place, I felt good about the song. George mentored me even during the recording process. He had a mic set up inside his booth, and he'd send up shout-outs or sing along. We'd be out there recording the basic tracks and hear this great voice coming through the little transistorized speaker. When we set up the vocal booth and it was just me doing my vocals, George came into the studio, put on headphones, and sang and danced along with me while I was singing. He was like a big brother to me, thoughtful, totally sensitive, an understanding of the colorful and zany place where we were coming from. I wanted never to let him down. We finished the record, and in our minds, it so far surpassed anything we thought we could have done that we were thinking we were on the road to enormity. Some EMI execs made a trip out to Detroit to hear some of the material. We played them a few tracks, and instead of them going, "You guys are going to be huge," they said nothing. I'm dancing and singing along, going nuts, and they're like, well, we'll see what we can do with this. Of course, we're talking about a record company that did not have an inkling of the awareness necessary to take something different and original and recognize its worth and introduce it to the world. They were looking for another band like Roxette. We went back to LA feeling absolutely accomplished and more experienced, and then everyone jumped back into his madness. By this time, Jennifer's mother had moved from Cahuenga to an apartment complex in Pasadena. Right next door to that was an abandoned building, so Jennifer and I started squatting there. The hot and cold water still worked, and we ran an extension cord into the building so we could listen to music, and we set up a bed and some candles. That's when I really started getting into heroin sex. I realized that if you were in love with somebody and you were sexually inspired to begin with, being high on heroin could amplify the experience tenfold, because you could have sex all night and not be able to come, but still be interested. I remember having these marathon sex encounters with Jennifer on that bed, thinking, life doesn't get any better than this. I'm in a band, got a couple of dollars in my pocket, got a beautiful, sweet, hot, sexy, crazy little girlfriend, a roof over my head, and some dope. Those feelings would disappear, and the next day I'd be off on a run. Jennifer would do her best to deal with my insanity, as she was slowly working on her own. Around the time I got back from Detroit, I intensified my relationship with a girl named Kim Jones. My friend Bob Forrest had this monstrous crush on Kim, but she had jilted him. He promptly wrote a song about her with the chorus, "Why Don't You Blow Me?" and the rest of the band. He was still obsessed with her, and he used to take me to her apartment in Echo Park, and we'd knock on her door to see if she was around. Bob would recite her many virtues. She was brilliant and beautiful, she studied in China, she wrote for the LA Weekly, she was from Tennessee, plus she was a lesbian because she had left Bob for this really hot girl. Turns out she wasn't a lesbian, but all of her other virtues were true. As soon as I met her, I knew we'd be best friends. We were both Scorpios, and there was never any sexual tension between us. In some ways, Kim was a female equivalent to Hillel, because there was no crime you could commit that she would not forgive you for, no heinous act of selfish behavior that she would not try to find the good side of you behind. Of course, she was also a complete mess. Intelligent but dizzy, a drug addict, codependent, an enabler and a caretaker, just a beautiful, warm, kindred spirit to me. I started to become closer and closer to Kim, because she was a source of love and comfort and friendship and companionship and like-mindedness without any of the difficulties of a girlfriend. I never lost my sexual attraction to Jennifer. The longer I was with her, the better the sex got, but I was not a great boyfriend. If I said I'd be home in an hour, I might stroll in 3 days later. Today, if someone did that to me, I'd have a heart attack. But when you're a kid, you don't know any better. Kim didn't care if I left for 3 days at a time, so there was no downside to hanging out with her. It was never like, "You motherfucker, you looked at that girl, you didn't come home, you spent all the money." Kim expected me to spend all the money, look at all the other girls, and disappear. One time I went over to Kim's house and she wasn't there. In a fit of desperation, I grabbed her toaster oven and traded it for a bag of dope. When she got home, she was unfazed. "That's okay, we'll get another one." Before long, I moved in with Kim, and our daily mission became getting high. She was getting some cash inflow, disability checks because her dad had died, checks from the LA Weekly, or checks from her mom at home in Tennessee. We'd cash them and meet some French guy or some Russian guy in a corner in Hollywood and buy the heroin, and if we had any money left over, we'd score some coke. Soon, we both had a habit. Hillel was also using, and he had a crazy girlfriend named Maggie who was a friend of Kim's, so we'd have a lot of small drug parties. From time to time, the band would go on tours to San Francisco. We were still young enough and not so damaged that we could play well, even though we had these drug habits. In September 1985, we played two shows with Run DMC, one in San Francisco and one in L.A. The L.A. show was at the Palladium, and besides opening for Oingo Boingo, it was our biggest show to date. Sold out. Of course, the night before the show, I went on a drug binge, so I showed up for the gig hammered on coke and heroin. The band was furious at me, but somehow I managed to pull it together and made it on stage. That show was notable for two things. About halfway through the show, George Clinton came out, rocking onto the stage, and he and I started doing a full, funky ballroom dance to our jams. He injected a fat dose of color and love and energy and meaning into that show. It was also memorable because shortly after George came out, I decided to interrupt the set and give a heartfelt, 10-minute-long rambling discourse on the dangers of doing drugs. I certainly hadn't planned the speech, but something came over me as I was looking down at my black and blue arms, and I just started rapping. If you haven't put a needle in your arm, don't ever do it. Let me tell you from experience that you don't have to do this. That's where I am right now, and it's horrible. And I don't want anyone to ever have to feel like I'm feeling right now. Let me do the suffering for you, because this is something that no one needs to subject themselves to. If you're doing this, okay, just do it, but don't ever think that you're going to be the same once you've gone this far. I proceeded to explain in detail why it was a big mistake to shoot drugs. I kept going. I couldn't hang up on it. Meanwhile, the band was shooting me looks like, oh my god, this fucking idiot. After the show, I was afraid to face the guys. I thought they'd hate my guts for saying that stuff, being a hypocritical moron. In the middle of everyone giving me dirty looks, my friend Pete Weiss, the drummer from Thelonious Monster, came backstage.
Swan, I've heard you say a lot of stuff from the stage, but that was the coolest shit you ever said, he gushed. That was riveting. You had every single ear in the place. They knew you were a fucked up bastard, but also that you cared and that you were just trying to share some love. Don't let that band of yours fool you. You did the right thing tonight.
A month later, when it was time to tour the U.S. for Freaky Styly, my speechifying hadn't changed anything for us. Both Hillel and I were strung out, but for the first time, I noticed that he wasn't doing so well. He seemed weak, and while I was able to bounce right back from a run, he didn't seem to have that Israeli fire stoking like he always had in the past. It became evident when we started our usual on-tour wrestling diversion. Hillel and I had teamed up. I was his manager, and he was set to wrestle Flea. Even though Flea was real solid, Hillel was bigger, and he had massive tree trunk legs, like a tall pan. We had a 2-week build-up to this match, and when they wrestled in the hotel room one night, Flea destroyed him in as long as it takes to grab somebody and hurl him to the ground and pin him mercilessly to his death. 10 seconds. I could tell that Hillel had no inner core of strength. He had been robbed by his addiction of the life force that allows you to at least defend yourself. It was a sad moment. Hillel and I didn't do heroin on the road, so we would drink bottles of Jägermeister, because that gave us the feeling closest to a heroin high. He'd always tease me that I was a sloppy drunk, because I'd get drunk and take off all my clothes in the motel, and walk down the hall and knock on people's doors, whereas he'd get drunk and act suave. Leaving to go on tour was an ordeal for me then, mainly because of my volatile relationship with Jennifer. Even though I was staying mainly at Kim's house, Jennifer was still my girlfriend. Jennifer became convinced that Kim and I were having sex. One day, she came by Kim's house, and Kim and I were sound asleep, naked and cuddling up. I know it would look like a bad scene if you were the girlfriend of the boy in the bed, but we were just having a nice drug high. No romance, just friendship. Jennifer didn't quite see it that way. Kim and I woke up to Jennifer shattering the bedroom window. She wouldn't come in with a good old-fashioned baseball bat. She made her entrance with an elaborately carved and painted bird-head cane from the Mayan lands. After she broke through the window, she proceeded to try to kill me with the cane. When it was time to leave on a tour, I'd avoid Jennifer for days before, because I knew some kind of hatchet was going to be thrown at me. One time, I was early to the breakout place, which was the EMI parking lot on Sunset. I was with Kim, and we were both completely high on heroin, sitting in the front seat of some car. I guess in my half-awake drug reverie, I had somehow unbuttoned Kim's blouse, because I wanted to see her milky white chest. I may even have been sucking on her nipple or holding her tit when, bam! 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 There was the loud sound of something rapping against the window. I looked up, and it was Jennifer. You motherfucker! You've been gone for days, and I knew that this was going on! She screamed. Jennifer, believe me, I may have had her shirt open, but I've never had sex with this girl. She's just my friend! I protested. You said you were coming home 3 days ago, and you're leaving for 3 weeks, and by the way, I'm pregnant! She screamed. Meanwhile, the dispute had escalated to the sidewalk, and Jennifer was trying to kill me, or at least scratch my eyeballs out. Jennifer, you see, this is why I don't come home for 3 days before I leave. Because I don't want to get hit, and you're too hard to deal with, and I know you're not pregnant, because you just had your period, and I haven't had sex with you since you had your period, so don't try to tell me you're fucking pregnant. I tried to reason with her, but she was a bull. Not that I can blame her. There was no stopping her. And Kim was getting caught in the crossfire, so I ducked inside the EMI building. Jennifer followed me in and proceeded to pull my hair and scratch at my face. I was still high out of my mind and trying not to lose an eyeball or a tuft of hair, so I started running through the halls. Jennifer chased me. For some reason, I had a bag of cookies, so I started throwing the cookies at her to keep her far enough away that she couldn't connect with any of her punches. She grabbed some blunt instrument, so I put my foot out to keep her from hitting me with it, and she went further nuts, if that was possible. "Don't you try to kick me in the stomach just because I'm pregnant! I know you want to get rid of the baby!" she screamed. Thankfully, Lindy came to my rescue. "Jennifer, we're only going away for a couple of weeks. I know how much this boy loves you. You're all he ever talks about." Somehow, we made it out on the tour in one piece. Despite our touring, EMI never got behind the album, and they wouldn't give us any money for a video. That didn't stop us. Lindy had one of the first home video cameras, and he shot footage on our tours and took that footage and cut it into a BBC documentary that had filmed us lip-syncing Jungle Man at the Club Lingerie in Hollywood. He attached two VCRs in some back room at EMI, did an edit, and we had a video for $100. Later, our good friend Dick Rude shot a video for Catholic Schoolgirls Rule that featured a shot of me singing from the cross, among other blasphemous things, so that video got played only in clubs. When we weren't touring, I was pretty much staying high. It was like Groundhog Day, every single day, exactly the same. Kim and I would wake up and have to look out of her window to see which direction the freeway traffic was going to determine whether it was dusk or dawn. Then we'd hustle up some money, get the drugs, shoot up, and go for a walk around Echo Park Lake, holding hands, in a complete haze. If I was supposed to show up for a rehearsal, I would probably miss it. If I did show up, I'd be too stoned to do anything, so I'd nod out in the corner of the room or pass out on the loading dock. Every day, Kim and I would get high, and right in the middle of the euphoria, we'd vow that tomorrow we were going to get off that stuff. The next day, we'd start the whole process over again. By now, a lot of our friends were strung out on dope, and often the only time we'd see each other was when we were in our cars waiting to cop. We were each scoring from the same French guy, so we'd page him, and he'd call back and say, "Meet me at Beverly and Sweetsail in 10 minutes. We'd drive down there, and on one corner, we'd see Hillel and Maggie in their car, and on another corner, we'd see Bob Forrest and his girlfriend. The dealer would go from car to car, and Kim and I would always get served last, because we were the most likely either to not have the right amount of money or to owe money. But we were patient and willing to take whatever we could get. Then we'd go back, and I'd be in charge of splitting the bag and loading the syringes. Because I knew I had a much greater tolerance to heroin than Kim, unbeknownst to her, I would always take 75% of the bag and give her the rest. Ironically, that practice almost killed her. It happened at Hillel's one night. He had moved into an infamous Hollywood haunt called the Milagro Castle, right off Gower. Marilyn Monroe had once lived there, but now it was populated with drug dealers and punk rockers. One night, after we scored some China White, Kim and Hillel and I went to his place to do the drugs. Hillel had his bindle, and Kim had our bindle, and for some reason, Hillel offered to share his with Kim so I could have a whole bindle to myself. I was in such a frenzy over doing my stuff that it didn't dawn on me Hillel would actually split his bag 50-50 with Kim. The high was amazing, and I remember Hillel and I going into the kitchen and sharing some Lucky Charms, dancing and talking and generally exuberant about how potent the drugs were. Then I realized we hadn't heard a peep out of Kim for a while. It dawned on me that she'd taken more than she ever had before. I rushed into the living room and saw Kim sitting upright in the chair, basically dead. She was cold and white, and her lips were blue, and she wasn't breathing. Suddenly, I remembered all the techniques for reviving someone from a heroin overdose that Blackie had taught me when I was 13 years old. I picked her up, dragged her into the shower, turned the cold water on her, and began giving her major mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. I was frantically slapping her face and screaming, "Kim, don't fucking die on me! I don't want to have to call your mother and tell her that her daughter's gone! I don't want to have breakfast alone tomorrow!" She started going in and out of consciousness. I was shaking her like a rag doll, screaming, "Stay awake!" Hillel had called 911, and when the paramedics showed up, I jumped out the window and ran away because I had outstanding warrants for my arrest for moving violations. Hillel went to the hospital with her, and they got her up and running. About 12 hours later, I called her room in the hospital. "Come and get me. Those motherfuckers ruined my high," she said. "I'm sick. We need to go cop." Amazingly enough, it never occurred to me that there might have been a problem there. From time to time, I'd make half-hearted attempts to get clean. One of them was at the urging of Flea, who suggested that I might want to get off the stuff for a while and reconnect with what we were doing as bandmates. He was living in this cute apartment on Carmen Street, and he proposed that I come and kick on his futon. I showed up with a couple of bottles of NyQuil and said, "Flea, this is going to be ugly. I'm not going to be able to sleep, and I'm going to be in serious pain. Are you sure you want me in your house?" He was willing, so we listened to music, and I kicked. After a while, Flea said I should get an apartment in the building, so I did. Of course, Jennifer promptly moved in with me. Unfortunately, a new dope dealer named Dominique, who had usurped all the other French dealers, lived only about a block away. Then it was time to go out on another tour leg. The night before, Jennifer and I were having one of those marathon sex heroin sessions. We'd have sex for a couple of hours, and then we'd fight for an hour about me leaving the next day, and she'd be screaming as loudly during the sex as she was when she was yelling at me for going on tour. It was hard to distinguish when we were fighting and when we were having sex. So a neighbor who hated me called the cops on what he thought was a domestic violence thing. I was in the house, surrounded by tons of syringes and spoons and heroin, when the cops came to the door. "We got a domestic violence call here," the one cop announced. "What are you talking about, domestic violence? It's me and my girlfriend, and that's that," I said. "Can we come in and take a look around?" the cop asked. I was saying no when Jennifer came to the door. She was obviously not abused, but she was hot-headed and still screaming at me. One cop was trying to poke his head in the door and shine his flashlight on Jennifer. In the meantime, the other cop had run a check on me and found the outstanding warrants, so they arrested me on the spot and dragged me out in handcuffs, half naked. All the neighbors were watching, convinced I was getting arrested for beating up a girl. Jennifer and I were screaming at each other as they took me away. It was just a bad episode of Cops. Thankfully, Lindy bailed me out, and we left on tour the next day. But during that period of my life, you had to plan on something like that happening before a tour. Or when we got back from a tour. We were returning from a freaky, styly tour leg when I ran into Bob Forrest, who was waiting for us at the EMI parking lot. Bob was the classic shit-stirrer of the city. If he could stir the pot, if he could drop a hint, if he could make drama and conflict, he would. He loved it because, God knows, he was falling apart at the seams, and I'm sure it took some of the attention away from him. Bob knew about my indiscretions on the road, but I was surprised when he came up to me and said, "Okay, you're out there doing all that crazy stuff. Don't you ever worry about Jennifer?" That was the last thing I would have worried about. In my mind, she would never do anything to betray me, even though I was cheating on her left, right, and center. He smirked. "I got some bad news for you, buddy." My heart started pounding in my chest. "My friend, the unusual hour is upon us when I'm going to share with you information you might not be too keen on," he continued. "Maybe a certain someone wasn't so loyal to you while you were away either." "You're crazy," I stammered. "Jennifer would rather cut her own wrists than take interest in another man. She loves me with every cell in her body. She's physiologically and emotionally incapable of giving herself to another man." "No, it's possible. Because I have proof." I threatened to crack his skull open on the pavement if he didn't tell me all he knew. Finally, he spilled the beans. Jennifer had slept with Chris Fish, the keyboard player of Fishbone, one of our Brother LA groups, while I was out on tour. But it still didn't compute to me. I could have seen if she'd slept with Angelo Moore, who was the good-looking lead singer. What girl didn't want to fuck Angelo? But Chris Fish? A guy with bad dreadlocks and worse fashion sense? I was mortified. It hadn't mattered that I had slept with 100 girls on the road in the last year. This killed me. The reality of my friend and my girlfriend doing this while I was away was incomprehensible demoralization to the 10th degree. I felt paralyzed. I probably gave myself cancer at that moment. What could I do? For some reason, I went to my father's house and formulated a plan. First, I picked up the phone and called Chris. "Chris, did you fuck my girlfriend?" There was a giant pause. Then a slow and stunned voice said, "Oh, man. Bob spilled the beans." I took a deep breath. "You're not going to come after me, are you?" "I'm not going to come after you. But you are not my friend, and stay the fuck away from me," I warned. End of conversation. He wasn't my problem. Jennifer was. I called her. "Jennifer, I know what happened. Nothing happened, she protested.
No, I know exactly what happened. I've spoken to Chris, and we are finished. She started protesting, claiming Chris was lying, but I was adamant. We're finished. Don't ever come around me. I hate your guts. Goodbye forever. I hung up, and I meant it. It was time to move on. This sense of excitement came over me, and I called up Flea, and he and I and Pete Weiss went out driving. I stood on the top of the car as it was rolling down the streets of Hollywood, screaming, I'm a free man! I'm a free man! We had toured on and off till the spring of 86, and now it was time to start thinking about our next album. One of the producers we were considering was Keith Levine, who had been in Public Enemy. I knew Keith and thought he was a great guy, but I also knew he was a heroin addict, so we were in for a convoluted experience. But that sounded great to me, since I was a mess. The more convoluted the landscape was, the less obvious I would seem as a fuck-up. EMI had given us a budget of $5,000 for the demo, and that seemed pretty high to me. There was no way a demo could cost that much. When I brought it up with Hillel and Keith, I found out that they'd earmarked $2,000 for drugs to make the tape. I don't think Flea agreed to it, and I know Cliff had no idea. He was just caught up in the maelstrom of insanity. I was late for the session, and as I pulled up at the studio, I wondered if they had been serious about putting aside funds to get high. The first thing I saw when I walked in that room was a mountain of cocaine and a small molehill of heroin. Hillel was fucking gazacked. They told me that the first $1,500 worth of drugs had already been consumed, so I started scooping and grabbing and snatching and saturating and got so loaded I was in no shape to be part of a creative process. Poor Cliff was off in the corner of the studio, tinkering with what was then a brand new device, a drum machine. You would hit the pads to create a pre-programmed drum sound, and you could record your own sound so you could play the drums with whatever sound you wanted. Cliff's favorite was a baby crying. It was a low-tech device, but Cliff was fiddling with it as obsessively as we were with the drugs, laughing in a strange, nervous fashion. He looked at me and said, I could play with this thing for 10 years. This is like a whole band within itself. I remember thinking, that's what he wants to do. He's sick of this circus, and he's looking at this machine and seeing his future. It was obvious that Cliff's heart was no longer in the band. He didn't quit, but we sensed that he didn't want to continue, so Flea visited him and gave him the bad news. He took it pretty hard and had bitter feelings for a couple of years. But then Jack Irons, our original drummer, decided to come back to the band, which was as much of a shocker to me as when Hillel came back. Something must have happened with What Is This to shake Jack's loyalty, because he was not the kind of person to leave something for a better career opportunity. Whatever, he missed us, and he loved us, and he wanted to play music with us. So he came back, and we began to write music again as the original foursome. Then someone else came back into my life. About a month had gone by since I split with Jennifer. I was still shooting a lot of heroin and cocaine, not learning anything. I wasn't growing as a person. I wasn't setting goals or working on my character defects. I was just a fucked-up drug addict. One night, about 3 a.m, there was a knock at my door on Carmen Street. It was Jennifer. She was working as a go-go dancer at a club, and it was obvious that she had come right from work, because she was dressed up in 1,000 different colors, with feathers and boots and chains and crazy makeup that must have taken her a few hours to apply.
"Please, just let me in. I miss you. I miss you," she begged.
"No chance," I said. "Just go. Don't get me in trouble. Don't start yelling. I don't need cops at my house." I closed the door and went back to sleep. When I woke up, I saw Jennifer curled up on the welcome mat outside my door, sound asleep. This went on for the next few weeks. Every night, she'd come up and either knock or curl up and go to sleep on my doorstep. I even started going out my kitchen window and climbing down a huge lemon tree that was right outside, and which came in handy when I scored some Persian heroin, which was oil-based and had to be cooked up in lemon juice. One night, I succumbed. I can't remember if I gave in to her love, or if I was so bad off that I needed $20, or if she came offering drugs, or whatever sad, sick, and bizarre circumstance it was. But I let her in, and we picked up where we left off. High as kites together, back into the mix of a totally dysfunctional but passionate relationship. So passionate that it would be documented on a video that became a cult classic in the underground club scene of L.A. It happened one night at the Roxy. Some people had organized a benefit for Sea Shepherd, a hardcore version of Greenpeace, and the Chili Peppers were asked to play. The theme of the night was that every band would cover a Jimi Hendrix song.
There was a great bill that included Mike Watt, our friend Tree, and Fishbone, so we were psyched to play. When I showed up at the gig, Fishbone was about to go on. Earlier, there had been some discussion of Jennifer singing backup with Fishbone, but I kiboshed it. You were not going on stage with that guy. Fishbone took the stage, and I made my way to the balcony. When I looked down, there was Jennifer on stage. That was not good. Now I had to make her pay for disrespecting me like that in front of my friends. At the same time, I kept my focus, because what really mattered to me was that I sang Foxy Lady well. Right before we were scheduled to go on stage, this young hippie girl walked backstage. She had brown hair, was really pretty, and had these huge tits poking through her tank top that couldn't help but be in everybody's face. A light bulb went off in my head. I went over and whispered in her ear, "We're gonna do Foxy Lady, and when we get to the end of the song, when we're freaking out on stage, I want you to come out and dance with me naked. Two can play the same game." The hippie goddess agreed. We went out and killed Foxy Lady. It was like our band could have levitated. The drums were happening. Flea was digging in. Hillel was orbiting. I was giving it everything I had. I almost forgot there was supposed to be a surprise guest. We came to the end of the song, and this slinky young hippie walked on stage. She hadn't gotten completely naked, but she was topless, and her big tits were just to-ing and fro-ing across the stage. She came up to me and started to do her hippie shimmy next to me. Norwood, the bass player from Fishbone, came out to join us, and we sandwiched the semi-naked girl. Suddenly, a figure flew on stage as if shot out of a cannon. It was Jennifer. She grabbed Norwood, who's a big man, and tossed him aside like a rag doll. Then she grabbed the girl and literally threw her off the stage. Meanwhile, the band kept going. I realized that I was about to become the recipient of some serious pain. By then, I had wound up on the floor on my back, singing the outro. And there was Jennifer, coming at me with fists and feet, punching and connecting and going for my crotch with her boots. I was trying to block the punches, all the while not missing a note. She kicked my ass till I finished the song and somehow escaped and ran off into the night. Between my dysfunctional girlfriend and my dysfunctional platonic friend and my dysfunctional self, my life continued on a downward spiral. We had settled on a producer for our third album, Michael Beinhorn. He was a very intelligent fellow from New York who was into all of the same music that we were and had produced a hit by Herbie Hancock called Rocket. But I was stuck in my groundhog year, waking up every morning to the same gray reality of copping to feel right. I went on another horrible heroin run with Kim and stopped being productive. I was withering away, mentally, spiritually, physically, creatively. Everything was fading out. Sometimes doing heroin was nice and dreamy and euphoric and carefree, almost romantic feeling. In reality, I was dying and couldn't quite see that from being so deep in my own forest. The few times I showed up at rehearsal, I wasn't bringing anything to the table. I didn't have the same drive or desire to come up with ideas and lyrics. They were still in me, but the process was thwarted, numbed out. We'd written some music for the third album, maybe four or five songs, but we needed a lot more. The whole band was suffering from Hillel and me being on drugs, but I was the much more obvious candidate to put the onus on, because I was literally asleep at rehearsal. One day I showed up to rehearsal, and Jack and Hillel and Flea, who probably loved me more than any other three guys on earth, said, "Anthony, we're kicking you out of the band. We want to play music, and you obviously don't, so you have to go. We're going to get a different singer and go on, so you're out of here." I had a brief moment of clarity when I saw that they had every right in the world to fire me. It was an obvious move, like cutting off your damn foot because it was gangrened so the rest of your body wouldn't die. I just wanted to be remembered and acknowledged for those two or three years that I had been in the Red Hot Chili Peppers as a founding member. A guy who started something. A guy who made two records. Whatever else came after that was theirs. Part of me was genuine in letting go of the band, but what made it so easy for me to accept was that now I knew I had zero responsibilities, and I could go off with Kim and get loaded. Much to their amazement, I shrugged and said, "You guys are right. I apologize for not contributing what I should have been contributing this whole time. It's a crying shame, but I understand completely. I wish you guys the best of luck." And I left. Once I didn't have anywhere to report to, it went from worse to worse than worse. Kim and I went for it. We were getting more desperate, and we owed too much money to the drug dealers around Hollywood. So we started walking from her house, which was not far from downtown Los Angeles, to known drug neighborhoods, mainly 6th and Union. We went down and started introducing ourselves to these different street characters. I met a pretty talented hustler right off the bat. He was this scurvy street urchin, an out-of-control white trash drug addict who was moving deftly in the downtown Latino drug world. He became our liaison to all the other connections. He still lived with his parents in this little wooden house. The kid was covered with track marks and abscesses and disease from head to toe, but he was a master of the downtown corners. Kim and I were always such petty, punk-ass, low-budget buyers that he would always do us right. We trusted this guy. We'd buy bindles of cocaine and bindles of heroin and walk a couple of blocks into these residential neighborhoods and shoot up right there on the street. We still had an air of invincibility and invisibility, so we thought we couldn't be touched. About a week after I was terminated from the band, I had a defining moment of sadness. I was talking to Bob Forrest, and he told me that my ex-band had been nominated for L.A. Band of the Year at the first annual L.A. Weekly Music Awards. For our circle, that was similar to getting nominated for an Oscar, so it was pretty exciting. Bob asked me if I was going to go to the ceremony. I told him I wasn't talking to the guy, so I couldn't imagine showing up. But the awards show happened to be at the Variety Arts Theater, a classic old venue right smack downtown. Coincidentally, I was in the same neighborhood that night, trying to hustle more drugs for my money than anyone wanted to give me. I was down to my last $10, which is not a good feeling, because on a night like that, you want to be inebriated, and instead, I was barely high. I remember doing a speedball with some gang dealer guys when I realized the LA Weekly event was going on. I stumbled into the lobby of the theater in a bit of a haze. It seemed unusually dark inside, and there was hardly anyone there, because the show was in progress. The doors that led down the aisles of the theater were open, so I leaned up against one of those doors and started scanning the audience for my old bandmates. Sure enough, they were in the front. I hadn't been there for more than a minute when I ran into someone I knew who said, "Man, you shouldn't be here. This is going to be really sad for you." Just then, they announced the winner of LA Band of the Year. The Red Hot Chili Peppers! "We won! We won the damn award!" I cheered to myself. I looked over at the guys, and they all had big grins and a pep in their step as they marched up on stage in their fancy suits and hats. Each guy got his award and made a little speech like, "Thank you, LA Weekly! Thank you, LA! We rock! We'll see you next year!" Not one of them mentioned our brother Anthony, who did this with us and who deserved a part of this award. It was like I had never been there those last 3 years. Not a fucking peep about the guy they had kicked out 2 weeks before. No rest in peace. No may God save his soul. No nothing. It was a poetically tragic, bizarre, and surreal moment for me. I understood getting kicked out, but I could not understand why on earth they didn't have the heart to give me a shout from the podium. I was too numb to feel sorry for myself. I was just trying desperately not to think about how bad I had fucked up and trying to escape any responsibility or reckoning. So I just said, fuck 'em, to myself, and tried to borrow $5 from someone in the lobby so I could go out and continue to get high. Money for drugs was a real issue for us, but one day Kim got a big check, and we went out and got a ton of smack and went back to her place to do it. I got so high and felt so good that I said to Kim, "I gotta get off this stuff." Sometimes when you get high, you think you're going to feel that good for the rest of your life, and you actually believe you can get off dope. You can't imagine that euphoria ever going away. "I'm going to call my mom, go back to Michigan, and get on methadone," I told Kim. As far as I knew, that was the cure for addiction. We were drooling and way too high for anyone's good, but Kim thought it was a great idea, so I picked up the phone and dialed my mom. "You're not going to believe this, but I have a pretty bad heroin problem here, and I'd like to come back to Michigan and get on methadone, but I don't have a penny to my name," I said. I'm sure my mom was in shock, but she immediately tried to act together and rational. She must have sensed that my life was on the line, and that if she flipped out and got judgmental, I would never come home. Of course, if she could have seen the way we were living, she would have had to be committed to a mental asylum. She made the arrangements, and the next day the ticket arrived, but we couldn't stop getting high. The day of the flight came, but we had been getting high all night, and when it was time to go to the airport, we were incapable of getting it together. I called up my mom and made up some stupid lie about why I couldn't leave that day, but I changed the ticket to the next day. That went on, and each time it was, "I'm coming tomorrow, I'm coming tomorrow," while Kim and I were up in her house getting plastered. Finally, I made up my mind to leave, but I had to do one last run and get really good and loaded right before the flight so I could be high the whole way home. The morning of the latest flight came around, and we went downtown to buy a bunch of balloons of dope and some coke. Kim was driving